Great. Thanks very much, Ingrid. I'm sure many of you have lots of comments and questions, but we'll keep those for afterwards, if that's OK. I'm going to hand over to Justin now and welcome him. And thanks very much, Justin.
Good afternoon, everybody. I leave Ingrid's quote there because my quote is, it doesn't come with a PowerPoint presentation. And indeed, having heard from Hammarskjöld and Einstein and many others, I want to bring you the wisdom of one Roy Keane, captain of Ireland in perpetual status, who said after the disaster in Saipan, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. And that might sum up roughly what I am going to share with you this afternoon. I don't think Roy thought of that himself, but he certainly brought it to a new audience that wouldn't otherwise have accessed that piece of wisdom. There are other catchphrases around. Survival is the new success. Don't waste a good recession. You know, in Trokra, speaking as a practitioner in this area, providing leadership and so on, those ring true a bit. We are running very fast to standstill in terms of raising money from the public and managing to keep the government funds coming along anyway, although much reduced. And recently we had an evaluation of our work by MAPS, the Government Multiannual Funding Scheme. And it was very interesting that the evaluators saw in our work that over the last 2 years since disaster struck, we have made much more progress towards reaching our strategic goals than we might have done otherwise. In other words, we took the decisions that we weren't brave enough to take when there wasn't the pressure on to take them. And some of those were painful. 15 redundancies from head office, 4 offices closed overseas, 32 redundancies there, cutting back on programs, staff having to go down to partners of long standing and say, sorry, we're out of here, don't have the money. Very, very difficult stuff. But in a strange way, perhaps better able now to cope with the future than we were when we were living off the fat of the calf of the Celtic tiger, if that's not a mixed metaphor of many sorts. And, you know, where one didn't have to be as rigorous as one might. Performance management. You know, all those people who were kind of half being managed and what were they doing really? And it was all kind of interesting, but was it adding any value to our total effort? Money sitting in bank accounts that, you know, really should have been either spent or back in head office. In fact, that was our lifeline. Had we not found that stuff, we might have had to wind up a year ago. So it's very interesting to see what has happened as a result of the recession and the impact it has had. So it has really led us to look very closely at where we're going. And just to introduce you to my plug, this is our Trokra Leading Edge report, which was launched at the end of March, where we, over a course of a year, undertook a project to interview 80 people involved in development work, north and south, east and west, academia, ministries, NGOs and so on, to try and get a sense of what is happening now in the light of all that we've been through for the future of development. And my comments are based on that report, and you can find it on our website, and I have a one pager out of it which I leave down at the coffee later. But some of the things that emerge from that are, you know, the 90s was kind of a golden era for NGOs. There was falling aid, and, you know, we were the kind of the heroes. The people are out there at the cliff front, whatever it is, and going to places nowhere else could get to, down there with the communities, getting our hands dirty, and donors loved us. Well, we'll give them the money, and sure, they'll make great use of it. And we kind of got somewhat intoxicated, I think, on this sense of our almost omnipotence. You know, the NGOs, we were a bit like the church and the banks, you know. You couldn't criticise them, and we know what happened to the other two. And I suppose the question is, you know, when is it coming our way? And indeed, it is kind of coming our way. And so, you know, where are we now in relation to all of that? We've seen that when, as aid budgets began to increase, that we became much more corporate in our approach, lots of strategic plans and all that kind of stuff, log frames, all the business of you're getting the thing professionalized, everyone is trained up by DTalk, and taking on bigger budgets and looking to the private sector in Swanford lead and even to government. And some of the comments that have come back to us in our research from our southern partners is, where is the passion gone? You know, where are all the risks that you guys used to take? You can't afford to take a risk now because failure is somehow not acceptable in a new environment of aid effectiveness and showing value for money and have to reach the MDGs, got to get those figures up there because otherwise we're somehow not doing what we're supposed to do. And then there's the question of the independent voice that was so critical and that had people out on the streets and so on up to, make poverty history and what have you. Now, I mean, how many of us, either as or individual organisations, as part of wider networks, global networks and what have you, now find ourselves working as partnership with major donors, on large projects, delivering agendas and, afraid in some ways, perhaps, I raise the question, to be overcritical now because, where will the funds go? Are these not now our new friends, our colleagues in the development sector, in whichever international organisation it is, and so on? So have we been lulled into this kind of moving away from what civil society organisations should be about, the expression of the concern of citizens for global justice, for fellow citizens in poorer countries, that kind of sense of solidarity? So when you come to kind of being brave or looking for the future, providing leadership, it seems one has to take up these issues and start to ask some questions about them and challenge ourselves. In terms of the aid effectiveness and the MDGs, for instance, being pushed towards technical services, specialised technical abilities, and at what expense? I mean, are we actually finding that we are pushing out those partners that we traditionally had who can no longer respond to this agenda of getting the results in order to have something that is more demonstrable? As a friend of mine said, this is a quote from a pal, so this is quite good. What gets measured gets done. That was the big kind of thing of your corporate world. But he says, what gets measured does not transform. Now, you can debate it, but it's an interesting point of view. And as other people remarked, what happened in Egypt and in Tunisia and so on didn't come out of log frames and strategic plans. And you couldn't measure it in any shape or form, but boy, did it bring a result. So, what we ask ourselves is this shift in, the value for money demonstrating impact and so on, actually moving us away from local civil society organisations, human rights organisations and so on, who are trying to deal with issues of rights and governance in their own countries, and that we have kind of left them behind or are being seen to do so? That is a real question, I think, that we have to ask. So I think there are three categories under which we can maybe just look at some of these. I think one is, what is the relationship now between northern NGOs and their southern counterparts? What is it now, and how does it relate to the environment we find ourselves in? What is the relationship of northern NGOs to their political influence? And Ingrid has talked about that to a certain extent there. And how do northern NGOs cope with the changing funding environment? So in relation to the relationships with our southern partners, the kind of feedback that we have been getting from our research is that, northern NGOs need to do much more to understand the situation in southern countries than we have done heretofore. I mean, we have been very much involved in doing our own planning, our own policies, and kind of implementing these programs and so on from where we are located and kind of arriving into developing countries. But where is the accountability towards those people whom we are trying to serve? And we in Trocar are finding this a very difficult one to come to terms with. Accountability is always perceived as upwards. So, we get the money from so-and-so, and we report to them, and they report to them, and they report to them. But this issue of NGOs in the north actually being accountable to the people whom we serve is relatively new, which is quite shocking. So it's certainly new in our thinking. I suspect in Ingrid's it isn't. But in terms of it coming home to roost, what is our accountability to all of these communities whom we foist ourselves upon sometimes without their invitation or anything and proceed to engage with them? And what do we really know about them? What do we know about the reality of their lives and the political and economic context in which they are operating? And I think all too often over a number of decades, the Northern NGOs have been shown up, sadly, in that light. I can just think of one example is the post-Rwanda genocide situation, where thousands of NGOs in the camps in Democratic Republic of Congo, in Tanzania, and so on, and then inside Rwanda itself, manipulated by all kinds of political operators, be they European or the local or the Janissaire, whoever it was, and people just wandering in without any real analysis of what's going on here. And we can too easily, I think, just operate out of our own paradigm of, well, we have the money, we're very well intentioned, and sure, isn't education good for everybody, or healthcare, or whatever it is, without having any real analysis of what the impact of that intervention has in local societies. So the need to be more humble in our approach, to be open, to really engage with local civil society, and to understand where they're coming from, to get their input into our thinking, and to enable them to build, in a sense of partnership, local civil society capacity. We do have things to bring, and I don't want to get into a kind of a Northern NGO bashing here. You know, we've a long tradition, we've lots of experience, and we do have resources. It's how we apply it, I think, is the real challenge now in these changed circumstances. And our local counterparts do need support around policy, research, media campaigning, fundraising, all the kind of things that we do well, that we could certainly help in terms of creating a kind of more global a culture of solidarity with our southern counterparts. And that will, of course, challenge our own competitiveness and our own kind of the way we kind of stand off against each other around limited funds, oh my gosh, or we've launched a report and they got their thing in their paper. How did that happen? All that kind of stuff. It's alive and well in this room and we know it, and we know it only too well. But I suppose at a seminar like this where you're standing back and saying, leadership, well, is it just to go along with that? Or are we in a position to make some brave decisions? I might say, well, look, we will try and break this culture for a greater good. In relation to advocacy, I think through my work in Concord with the European NGOs, we had an informal evening recently with a very senior official. I can't say who it is because there just might be media here. A very senior official who had retired from his post, and we said, now, over a bottle of wine, tell us the truth. What's really going on? And one of the things he said was, do you people not realise the power that you have? Now, Ingrid's just been talking about this. There is a power vacuum there. Nobody is in charge of anything. It's just a mess. And you people are just kind of wandering through this. And yet you can bring so much to bear. And he talked about past campaigns like the debt relief campaign and the landmines, and where really civil society got their act together and went out with clear thinking and clear positions and said, this is what we want. Actually, governments and international organizations rallied to these things because it was the only clear statement being made by anybody. And the accusation, and leveled against us, is that we just are not energetic enough around this stuff. There's too many people just wrapped up in their work and doing their projects and whatever it is and missing the big picture. So there's another challenge, in a sense, in terms of providing leadership, to recognise that we are part of the power structure and we need to use our leverage within it for the objectives that we share north and south. I have seen this at a number of occasions. The one the most stark to me was at the trade talks in Cancun in about 2004, 2005, I think it was. And after every session, commissioners, ministers dashed out of the big meeting room and sat down with NGOs here and NGOs there and the trade unions and the farmers group and what have you. And the members of parliament, who are parts of national delegations, and the MEPs were all left standing around saying, is no one going to talk to us? And there was a real backlash from them, saying, we are parliament. We're the elected people. Who are you? Why are you over there talking to them? They were talking to the NGOs because they knew who was going to get their story in the paper the next day. That's why they were talking to the NGOs. I mean, that is power. And it's not that we in any sense as a movement or a group ever wanted to sideline Parliament. In fact, they should be our strongest allies. But it was a very interesting phenomenon to see this. And in Accra, just 3 years ago, on the high-level forum on aid effectiveness, Brendan Howland, now our esteemed minister, then he was the chair of AWEPA in Ireland, and he was there as the last Cian Chorla of the Dáil, made an impassioned plea from the plenary session representing parliamentarians to be included in the process. Like, it was really, really interesting stuff. So there we are. We have our place in the power structure. Do we understand it? Do we use it? Are we brave enough to do so? So now, maybe I'm going past my time. Oh, I haven't watched.
You have about another 2 minutes.
2 minutes, right. Well, let me just flick on then to the third one and just talk about funding. Because at the bottom of all evil, you know, is money. And I suppose this is the other thing that is coming out of our report, the need to plan for the new environment. And one of the things that is kind of emerging, and you can take this or leave it if you like, but it's the result of research that needs to be kind of tested against reality, is that there's a bit of a choice to be made around where our NGOs are going. Because with the agenda around the MDGs and the aid effectiveness and so on, you are seeing larger NGOs, international NGOs, and families of NGOs coming together and putting together large programs, you know, multi-million euro programs, and getting funding from government or from EU, what have you, to implement these very highly technical, you know, requiring a lot of expertise and being delivered, you know, in a very professional way. And the donors love it. This is aid effectiveness. This is photographable. This is stuff that'll keep the Public Accounts Committee just as happy as pigs in muck when we get home and show them all this. And, you know, there is a tendency to chase the money. Like, if we all want some of this, we've got to start getting our acts together and you'll go that way. But, you know, it's a very broad-based community, and can everyone do that? So it seems to me that there are some choices to be made around, do you follow the money and adjust your work accordingly and deliver much-needed technical services to people in the developing world? And let's face it, Southern Sudan is about to be launched upon the world at the latest state. And even Mary Robinson was saying just last week, what they need is technical services. So you can be there and you can deliver them. Or is there another way, which is about going back to the mission statement? What is it we're about? Where do we want to go? Is it this about just service delivery, or what about civil society, about rights, about governance, about all of those other very important political matters which see Southern societies taking control of their own destiny, their own development processes, holding their governments to account, and in the long run, developing clearly sustainable development projects that are rooted in communities and in people. And that is a real challenge, because, you know, if I were brave enough, I might say, well, we'll just get smaller. We'll just accept that we're not going to take that amount of government money again and find ourselves having to close down programs and make people redundant and all the rest of it. We will stick with our agenda. We'll take what fits within our strategic objective and no more. And we will work with Southern partners. We will try to build, you know, a different kind of partnership, and that will sustain us into the future. If I were brave enough. Thank you.